This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Girlfriend by Michelle Francis. This book is read by Henrietta Mier.
Prologue, Monday, March 2. I love my son. That was all that counted. It didn't matter that she was about to do something heinous. An opportunity had been granted to her, a beacon of light through the devastating last few months, and Laura knew she had to take that opportunity. She'd agonized over it for hours, but now that the decision was final, she felt a wave of terror at what she had to say. The words that were going to break her into pieces. This was the first time. She briefly considered rehearsing it, but the word, wouldn't form properly in her head. Her instinct was to bat it away violently. Crossing to the sink in the ensuite bathroom, just off the private room at the hospital, she looked at herself in the mirror hanging above. A brief check that her soul was still intact through her worn blue eyes reassured her further. No flashing green irises, no demon-like pinhole pupils. She looked more tired, though, and she was shocked to see how much she'd aged. There were more lines around her eyes and mouth. There was also a sadness, a haunting despair that she had desperately tried to keep at bay with this new, expensive hospital, the best doctors she could find, and brittle hope. For a moment, she forgot about what she was about to do, and thought only about what was soon to happen. The heartbreak was a physical force that made her double over, clutching the sink. After a few seconds, she stood. Nothing had changed. Cherry was back today. Laura had checked, and the flights from Mexico usually arrived at Heathrow early in the morning. She looked at her watch. Maybe she'd be back in her flat in Tooting by now. A lump formed in her throat as she held her phone, but she swallowed hard. She had to get this right. Any mother would do the same, she reminded herself again and again, a mantra to get her through it. She dialed the number carefully. She went cold, then clammy in alternative waves, buffeted around by her agony. Her life was soon to end, the life that had meaning. Holding the phone with two hands, trying to stop their shaking, she waited for the rings in her ear to be terminated.
1. 9 months earlier. Saturday, June 7. Laura had a good feeling about today. A delicious start-of-the-summer sensation had embraced her the minute she opened her eyes. She was up and dressed before it was even 7:30 on an already hot Saturday in June. Walking along the landing to Daniel's bedroom, she listened for sounds of him stirring, but the room that they kept clean and welcoming while he was at medical school was silent. He was still asleep. Hardly surprising, seeing as he'd come home long after she'd gone to bed the last couple of nights. Daniel had been home from university for 2 whole days now, but she'd not yet seen him. Work was at a pressure point, and she left early in the mornings, and he was out when she came home. Catching up with old friends, no doubt. She was envious of those conversations, hungry for information. She wanted to hear everything, soak it all up, enjoy the excitement she felt for him just starting out in his professional life, and relish the summer with him before he went off to do his hospital training. Today was their day. No last-minute urgent changes to the drama series she was producing for ITV that kept her in an edit suite until 9 o'clock at night. No meetings. Just a day together. Mother and son. She opened the door a crack, the smile ready on her face. The room was flooded with sunlight, the curtains wide and the bed made. She stopped there for a moment, confused, then realized he must have gone down to make breakfast. Glad that he was already up and about like her, she hurried excitedly down the stairs of her Kensington house and burst into the kitchen. It was empty. She looked around, a little lost, a pang of anxiety fluttering through her. Then she saw a piece of notepaper on the counter. Scrawled on it was a message. In the basement, we'll be hungry. She smiled. He knew she hated it to be called the basement. The word rang with a false modesty. It was a huge addition that went vertical instead of horizontal, and had cost her husband a fortune. Still, it was no worse than what he called it. Howard had wanted a den, he'd said, and she'd almost laughed at the absurd understatement, except that she knew he wanted his den in order to get away from her. He'd suggested it quite casually one night, and said it would be useful, somewhere for either of them to get a little space, and she'd struggled to hold back the astonishment and hurt. They hardly saw each other anyway. He was always at the office or golf or tucked away in his study. He had then employed some very skilled and expensive builders who had dug out the earth beneath their house and filled it with a game room, a wine cellar, a garage and a swimming pool. The neighbours had been upset with all the noise, the conveyor belts of rubble spewing out of the ground, and the general disruptive blot on the landscape. She'd been left to apologise, but at least it had been temporary and nothing like the steel magnate's 4-storey subterranean bunker down the road, which had caused his neighbours' front pillars to crack. Taking the elevator down to the pool, she waited for the hum of the motors to stop, and then stepped into a twilight of lapis lazuli blue. Cutting a frothy swathe through the sublit water was Daniel. As usual, the sight of him made her heart sore. She walked to the top of the deep end, just as he was finishing his length, and knelt down to the water's edge. He caught sight of her and stopped, water pouring off his strong shoulders as he hoisted himself effortlessly out of the water and threw his arms around her. She squealed in admonishment, as he knew she would do, grinning and holding her tight, and then, unable to resist, she hugged him back. Feeling the wet seep through, she pushed him away and brushed at the dark patches on her yellow shift dress. "That was not funny," she said, smiling.
"Just giving my old mum a hug."
"Less of the old?" In Laura's head, she was still 25, and often looked at other women, fascinated by their encroaching middle age, before realizing she was the same generation. It amused her that she was stuck in some sort of age amnesia, amused her still further when a look in the mirror confirmed that, although she looked good for her age, she most definitely was not 25.
"Come on, all the boys fancy you, and you know it."
She smiled. It was true she enjoyed the flirtatious company of Daniel's friends, the way they came around and leaned lazily on her breakfast bar, addressing her as Mrs. C., and telling her how good her French toast was. It had been a while since she'd seen them. "How are Will and Johnny?"
"Don't know."
Daniel started to dry himself with one of the plush towels that Mrs. Moore changed 3 times a week, regardless of whether or not anyone had used them. "But didn't you see them yesterday?"
"They work,"
he said flippantly, disappearing around the side of a carved wooden screen.
"Already out there changing the world."
"In insurance? And I'm aware they work. I was talking about the evenings. Where have you been, then, the last couple of nights, if not with the boys?" There was a silence from behind the screen, and Laura didn't see that Daniel was smiling, a secret smile of reflection. He'd meant to keep it to himself for a bit longer, but suddenly felt the urge to tell someone. Little by little, he would let out some, not all, of the details, enjoying reliving them as he did so.
"Hey,"
he said as Laura poked her head round. She stood, arms crossed, waiting for him to answer her question. "You're perfectly decent." She watched fondly as he pulled on shorts and a T-shirt, proud that her jeans had produced such a good-looking young man. Of course, Howard had had a part in it, but their son took after his mother in looks. Same height, same thick wavy blonde hair, and strong bone structure. Instead of giving her the answer he knew she wanted, he smiled cheekily as he made his way to the elevator. She took a sharp intake of breath.
"Don't you push that button. Are you coming?"
Laura followed and pretend pinched his earlobe. "I'm going to get it out of you." The lift started to rise.
"Ow! Can I take you for brunch?"
She lifted her eyebrows. "It requires an announcement." The doors opened, and he took her hand and led her out and through the hall into the expansive oak and granite kitchen.
"Just want to treat my mum."
"You old charmer. But before we go, give me a clue. I couldn't stand the anticipation." She stood firm. He poured himself a voluminous glass of juice from the fridge.
"I've been looking for an apartment. You know, for when I start the hospital training program."
She sighed. "You're sure I can't persuade you to move back home?"
"Ah, Mum, apart from the holidays, and not all of those, I haven't lived at home for 5 years.
It wasn't that Daniel led a louche social life. He just enjoyed his privacy, as any 23-year-old male would, and didn't want to spend the next 2 years living under his childhood roof, basement pool or not. "Okay, okay. So, apartment hunting. At night?" He grinned.
"Just meeting with the agent."
It took a moment, and then it clicked.
"A girl?" "She's very thorough. Knows exactly what I like."
"A girl?"
"You say it like I've never dated before."
"But this one's special," she said decisively.
How do you know?
Well, you've seen her the last two nights, haven't you?
Yes.
And only just met. Come on, spill. What's her name?
He was amused by her enthusiasm.
Cherry.
A fruit. Short season. Select.
What?
Exotic.
She's got dark hair.
He held up a palm, shook his head.
I can't believe I'm saying this.
Laura clutched his hand.
No, don't stop, really. I want to hear all about her. Where's she from?
Tooting.
She is exotic. Sorry, I was joking. I'll be serious now.
Laura kissed his hand contritely.
How old is she?
24.
And she's a real estate agent?
Yes, well, she's training at the moment. She's only recently started.
And she works here in Kensington?
She wanted to sell nice houses.
He heaved himself up onto the work surface.
She learned about the area by pretending to be moving here. Went to see 27 flats with other agencies before going for the job. Found she could talk about the properties and the likely clientele with aplomb. He laughed. That's what I call enterprise. And then, quite audaciously, made up a resume. Or at least embellished it. Made herself sound like the right kind of girl.
Laura smiled, although she was a little taken aback by Cherry's behaviour, which was silly as she had nothing to do with her work and wasn't her employer. She tapped Daniel's knee with the back of her hand.
Come on, I thought you were taking me out.
He jumped down and held out a crooked elbow.
It will be my pleasure.
He wanted to treat his mum, look after her, be the son that he knew she, somewhat embarrassingly, liked to show off. They'd sit in the brasserie and she'd bask in their mutual good humour, and he knew he'd enjoy himself too. He always made time for them to be together, especially ever since he'd been aware that the relationship between his parents had little warmth. There wasn't even much in the way of companionship. His father was rarely around, as his job as partner at a large accounting firm kept him fully occupied. Daniel wanted to make up for some of the loneliness that he knew his mum felt. It had been a while since he'd seen her, which added to the guilt, the prickly discomfort of another secret. He hadn't yet told her he was cutting their day short. He was seeing Cherry again tonight. 2 days earlier. Maybe having the best of everything when he was a child meant that he never yearned for anything, at least nothing that money could buy. Daniel had been bought a superb education and was clever, a fortunate combination that meant he liked school and school liked him. He'd shown a particular aptitude for science, which had delighted his parents and professors, particularly when he'd been invited to study medicine at Cambridge. To complement his academic cultivation, he'd had the holidays that were considered necessary. He'd learned to ski, to dive, and to appraise the world. He'd done all of this with an enjoyment, an interest, that had reassured and pleased his parents. But despite being lavished with everything a boy could want, Daniel had somehow managed to remain unspoiled. His response to the Great Wall of China was one of genuine wonder, and he was grateful for the comfort of the first-class flight home. However, when he'd arrived at Heathrow, he'd jumped on the tube rather than call his father's driver to come and pick him up. His laid-back attitude extended to clothes, and he grew perversely attached to items that had long since passed their best. Once he'd retrieved a pair of briefs from the trash that Mrs. Moore had thrown out on one of his trips home from university. He'd then hidden them, holes and all, in the side pocket of his holdall. Those briefs were old friends, and he would not be parted from them. And so it was that he set foot in a real estate agency on one of the most expensive roads in London that represented some of the most exclusive properties, while he was dressed in a faded T-shirt and a pair of cargo shorts with holes where the seams met at the pockets. "I need a flat," he said, smiling to the hesitant girl who politely approached him as he came in the door.
"To buy or rent?"
"Buy."
And he was directed to the back, where a dark head was bent forward over a large, gleaming wooden desk, scrutinising some papers.
"Can I help you?"
When she looked up and smiled her client-welcoming smile, he felt himself respond in kind. Suddenly the job of flat hunting seemed a whole lot more pleasant. She had a cap of straight raven hair, which danced as it moved around her face.
"I'm looking for a flat."
Her eyes were dark too, deep pools with fathomless depths. In them he caught the mental calculations as she subtly took in his frayed shorts and T-shirt.
"How many bedrooms? Did you have a particular location in mind?"
two bedrooms. He decided instantly, thinking the second would be useful as a study. He hadn't had much time to think about what he needed as he'd driven back from Cambridge early that morning. Wandering around his parents' house, he'd been aware of the likely pressure from his mother to stay if he became too comfortable. It was best to start the ball rolling straight away. It wouldn't be fair to let her get her hopes up.
And location?
Once again, he detected suspicion about what he was doing here. No streets around Kensington and Chelsea were cheap, but some were prohibitively expensive. He knew he didn't look the sort to have a couple of million to spend, which in theory, he didn't.
Cherry Lane?
Her face smiled tightly, irritated but trying to remain professional. There's no such street in the area.
God, no, I wasn't winding you up.
He pointed to her nameplate, black letters on brass background, and smiled.
You should be in an agency in a village in the Cotswolds or something.
She stared at him long and hard, then turned her iPad to face him. Depending on your price category, we have four properties that match what you're looking for. This one is just 2 minutes from Knightsbridge Station.
I'll go and see it.
She paused and tapped her screen. Okay, this next one.
I'll see that too.
But I haven't even told you about it. He enjoyed watching her uncertainty about how to take him. No doubt most people who came in here were stuffed with the importance of how a property should be, how it should rightfully fit their needs. They probably put great energy and effort into finding the perfect place, something that seemed to Daniel a colossal waste of time. The quicker he got it settled, the better.
And the others?
In a hurry?
I should imagine for the price they're all pretty nice. How much are they, anyway?
These particular properties range between 2.5 and 4 million.
Wow.
And yes, they're exceptional.
There you are, then. I need somewhere to live, and I'm sure I'd be extremely fortunate to live in any of those you've selected. So, should we go and take a look?
Her hands fluttered over the screen. I need to make appointments.
Later today, then?
He smiled.
I'm sure I'll be your easiest client. I'll have one picked by tea time. It is you showing me around, isn't it?
She flicked her eyes across him, reassuring herself she hadn't just encountered a psycho. Yes, she said firmly. It is. This time, he was smarter, she noticed. Since he'd walked into her office this morning, he'd changed into a pair of navy chinos and a light blue shirt. So far, he'd followed her obediently around the first floor apartment with little comment. She waved a hand toward the ground. As you can see, there are wooden floors throughout, and one of the benefits of this property is, of course, the hallway. He gazed up and down.
What's so special about it?
It's not so much that it's special, it's the fact it's there. He thought. In what world was a hallway considered a perk when you were paying £2.5 million? He didn't want to offend her by saying this, and after all, he was guilty by association. He was the one looking around it. And this is the living room, she said, indicating the room through a doorway. He peered in.
Nice sofa. Yellow.
Lemon, she corrected. Of course, these furnishings will be removed on sale. The owner has left them to present the property.
So it's vacant?
Yes, and there's no chain.
Did the owner not want the sofa at his or her new place?
Bemused, she looked at him. I should imagine.
What?
They bought new. He smiled, then followed her down the covetable hallway, glancing down to see if there was anything he might be missing, but decided to concentrate on Cherry instead. He liked the way she walked, with purpose, as if she cared about where she was going and the reason for getting there. He had a feeling she might extend this determination to other parts of her life, and he found himself wanting to know more about what they might be. Just then she turned and caught him staring at her. She stopped and folded her arms. The kitchen is in there, she pointed, and it was obvious he was meant to go first.
Sorry, I wasn't staring at your bum.
She raised her eyebrows at his outspokenness. Are you really interested in this flat? As much as there was a certain charm about this man, she couldn't bear time wasters, and she had a pretty good eye for spotting them, having been one herself, although that was justified as it was a means to an end.
Yes, he said quickly, wanting to reassure her. I'll take it.
But we haven't seen the others.
This is the cheapest of the ones you have available, right?
Yes.
Why pay more? Even this seems...
Yes?
Obscene.
She looked at him.
Sorry, I just find it a little offensive. All this money for one flat.
But you want to buy it?
Yes, please. And I'd like to buy the furniture, too, if it's for sale.
In fact, Daniel had been told in no uncertain terms by his father that renting was not an option. It was considered a complete waste of money, his father's money, really, as Daniel had a trust fund. If the flat passed his father's scrutiny, it would become a family investment.
Anyway, one flat's much the same as another, isn't it?
Cherry opened her mouth to speak.
Of course it's not. No, sorry. Consider me very ignorant, but I was just thinking. There are better things we could be doing with our time.
She braced herself, knowing what was coming next.
Are you free tonight, by any chance? Could I take you out for supper?
Cherry always found it amusing the way rich people called it supper, as if they'd never quite left boarding school. At least it gave her a little more confidence that he actually might be able to afford the flat he'd just so casually declared he'd have. This was actually her last appointment of the day. They were supposed to have seen the others the following morning. All she needed to do was return the keys to the office, and the evening was hers. She thought about her plans. A ride home on a sweaty tube that delivered other workers to various parts of South London that diminished in salubrity as the seats were emptied. She always felt left behind, the poor relation by the time they reached Tooting Broadway. But at least, she thought with a shudder, she wasn't quite at the end of the line. Then it was a quick stop in Sainsbury's to get something to eat before returning to her tiny flat with no hallway. She'd hang up her precious suit with the others, the most valuable things she owned, and then no doubt would spend the evening studying property on the internet and wondering just when she might be able to get out of there. She looked up at her client. She liked him, liked his devil-may-care attitude. It made a change from those who turned a property down because the bathroom fittings were chrome and not brass, and were offended when the seller wouldn't change them before closing. Why not go out for supper with this man, she thought. It was, after all, the reason she'd worked so hard to get a job in this part of town in the first place. 3. Saturday, June 7. Laura sat in her usual seat, at a right angle to her husband, and picked at her grilled chicken salad. All the windows in their large, airy dining room were open, but it still felt oppressive. She'd spent a languorous afternoon in the garden. Daniel had been sprawled out on a lounger, she under the giant umbrella. He would answer her questions with eyes closed against the sun, laughing at her enthusiasm to know everything about Cherry. She was taking full advantage of the fact he couldn't see her drink him in. Then, just when she'd stood to go and start cooking, he'd opened his eyes and sat up, with an awkward look on his face.
I meant to say...
She turned back, a smile on her face.
I sort of promised Cherry. It's a concert. In the park. I'm sorry, I know I said I'd stay home with you and Dad.
She quickly swallowed her disappointment and brushed off his apologies, telling him to go and enjoy himself. Laura looked down the length of the empty, gleaming formal table that seated 10, with just her and Howard clutching the end as if they were on a sinking ship, and suddenly felt an overwhelming irritation with it and the bizarre way in which they sat, following some dead ritual for so long neither of them questioned it. She turned her gaze to him. He didn't seem bothered by the table, the heat, the fact they'd stopped talking to each other. He was reading the Day's Telegraph, with his glasses pushed up onto his forehead, while filling his mouth with salad and new potatoes. He'd been out all afternoon. She was used to that. But now he was back, and she wanted to talk. She heard the chink of his knife on the china plate, the Mozart playing in the background, and her voice, intruding, sounded alien.
Anything interesting?
He didn't look up.
Just the golf.
The golf. She felt a twitch of hurt. That was one of the few things he still got excited about. That and Marianne, of course. She never knew which he was really doing. He'd always tell her it was the golf every Saturday, Sunday, and some weekday afternoons too, when he would get out of the office. However, she knew by the way he came back a little happier, a private happiness he kept within himself, which days he'd seen her. It wasn't that it was a surprise. That had come 20 years ago when she'd first discovered the affair. Mrs. Moore had gone through his pockets before taking the suits to the dry cleaners, and left the receipts on the kitchen worktop. She'd seen them at breakfast, after Howard had already left for work, and Laura knew in absolute certainty she'd not received those flowers, nor had she been taken to lunch the previous Saturday. He denied it at first, of course, but she knew, and eventually he angrily admitted it, as if it was her fault.
All right, it's true. Are you happy now?
It was the wrong choice of words. Of course she wasn't happy. Her world had just imploded, and then she discovered it had been going on for 2 years and he was in love with Marion. She was married too, though, had young children and wasn't prepared to split up the family. Laura considered leaving him. She had some money, so she would have been all right. But there was Daniel to think about. And Howard, in an emotional outburst, said he didn't want to leave his son, who was barely out of toddlerhood. So he promised to finish it, and she took him back. But things changed. Howard was miserable for weeks, working late and hardly saying a word, and the irony was that he never saw Daniel anyway. They fell into a pattern. He went to work, and she brought up their son. Laura was used to loneliness. Her childhood had been an endless string of nannies as her mother went to parties and her father was at work. She was an only child. It had been too inconvenient for her parents to have any more. Laura had longed for a relationship with her mother, but it never came, and both her parents were now long dead. Determined that Daniel wouldn't feel as abandoned as she had, she buried the hurt over Howard's affair into positive things for her son, clubs, holidays, friends. Their relationship grew strong, and Howard started to feel left out. He found it even harder to be at home and worked even longer hours, and the resentment grew. Because he felt sidelined, he became crueler to Laura, criticized her parenting when Daniel cried on the weekends at this man whom he didn't recognize, who picked him up. Then one evening, after Daniel had started university, Laura was at home while Howard went out for a drink.
"Just someone from the club,"
he said. It had harpooned her unexpectedly when she was filling the kettle with water, a sudden, swift plunge to her heart, and she dumped the kettle in the sink while she fought to breathe again. For she suddenly knew who someone from the club was. Marianne was back, now that their respective children had grown. And then she remembered he'd been out with someone from the club the week before. Before that, she couldn't remember and panicked while she racked her brain. After the revelation had subsided, she felt exhausted, beaten. She knew it was because those two were still in love. Gradually, golf had spread to whole weekends, and she saw him less and less. Occasionally, she considered whether she should ask him for a divorce, but it didn't seem to matter so much anymore. Even though she knew Howard was the cause of the loneliness, facing up to it, breaking them apart, would only make the wound open and raw. She'd always preferred to concentrate on other things. Daniel had been at the center of her life for so long, and now she was secretly thrilled with the notion that he'd found someone special, someone she might be able to be friends with. "Daniel's out again tonight."
"I assumed as much."
"That's the third night in a row."
He still hadn't looked up from the paper, and let out a small laugh.
"He's a grown man."
She suppressed her frustration.
"Yes, of course. He's with a girl."
Finally, Howard looked at her.
"Good for him."
She smiled.
"I think he's smitten. They only met 3 days ago, and he's seen her every night since."
"What's your point?"
"Oh, come on, Howard. Don't you want to know who this girl is who swept him off his feet?"
"You obviously do."
"Maybe I'll text him."
"Don't you dare."
He whip-cracked. Hurt, she paused, with the fork midway to her mouth.
"I'm joking."
"Leave him alone. Just because for the first time in his life you don't know every detail. Don't interfere."
"I'm not interfering,"
she said quietly, and suddenly wanted to leave the room. She put the napkin down on the table and got up. She was about to take her plate to the kitchen when...
"You're obsessive."
It was sudden, blunt.
"Possessive."
She stopped dead. Neither of them said anything for a moment. Then he got up from the table and left. Laura stood there, her plate in her hand. Tears pricked at her eyes, not just at the shock of the accusation, but because of the look he'd given her as he left. It was a look of deep resentment. She sat for a moment, and then, as if to stop his words settling on her somehow, she stood again quickly and walked into the kitchen. She knew better than to follow him. He'd gone to the den, and anyway, she didn't feel like confronting him, wasn't in the mood for an argument. The plate clattered on the counter, and then the anger and indignation at what he'd said came out. He was the one who had made himself absent all those years. What did he know about the mammoth job of bringing up a child? The all-encompassing care when they were tiny, the lack of sleep, the wiping of cheeks, hands, bums, tables, high chairs, wipe, wipe, wipe. The inability to go to the bathroom by yourself, the absolute knowledge that one hug from you would soothe the bumps and bruises, and those hugs had to be always available. The constant reverse psychology slash humour slash diversion tactics required to get through an average day with a toddler. He'd never had to deal with or suffer the heart-rending tears when they didn't want to go to nursery school, or try to work out why, when their four-year-old reasoning couldn't explain, they found it difficult to have the confidence to make friends. He hadn't had to make the decisions over sports, clubs and parties, or work out how to strike the balance between encouraging independence without making their son feel he was unsupported, or solve the night terrors after the sudden death of his grandfather from a heart attack. What did he know about any of this? She felt a rage at his appalling short-sightedness, and then, with a glass of wine, the anger subsided. Nobody knew any of this. Nobody but a mother. She picked up her wine and found her book by the fridge and took them into the darkening garden. The jasmine was beautifully pungent, its hundreds of tiny white star-like flowers just breaking out now that June had arrived. She lit the citronella candles, and soon the moths came to investigate. As she sat in the swing seat, she let her mind drift. It was funny thinking back. It had been practically just the two of them for years, and now Daniel was on the verge of moving out permanently. She was suddenly reminded of something he used to say when he was three. He'd pretend to be a puppy and bound around her.
"Woof," he'd say. "Do you like him?"
"He's gorgeous.
You can keep him if you want."
"Can I?"
"You can keep him forever."
And he'd throw his arms around her neck tightly. The cat came mewing pitifully, his tail like a toilet brush, and she saw a fox sniffing around the large opaque window in the middle of the lawn that formed part of the ceiling of the subterranean pool room. Moses jumped onto her lap and stood there, still meowing and waiting for salvation. She'd originally gotten him for Daniel when her son was 9, to teach him about looking after pets. He was a small, silver-grey Burmese, and she'd ended up growing quite fond of him. Picking up a small stone, she threw it in the direction of the fox. She disliked them, was wary of their capabilities and lack of boundaries. Recently, she'd heard a distraught, incredulous woman call into a radio breakfast show, talking about how a fox had brazenly walked in through the open back door and climbed into her baby's cot in the middle of the day. She shuddered. If that had been Daniel when he was small, she would have probably smashed the fox's head against the patio. 3 nights in a row, she thought with a smile. Who sees someone 3 nights in a row, right off? What did this girl have that was so special? As she mused about Cherry, she thought about another girl, a girl a tiny bit older than Daniel. Rose was Laura's firstborn. She'd been the perfect baby, eating and sleeping right on schedule from day one, which was why it had been so unusual when, at only a few days old, Laura had had difficulty waking her to nurse. When it happened again 3 hours later, Laura was worried enough to take her to the doctor. He took one look at her, and she was rushed to hospital. She was diagnosed with Group B streptococcus, contracted from undetected bacteria in the birth canal. After 24 hours, the doctors told them Rose was going to die. And 2 hours later she did, in Laura's arms. She was exactly 7 days old. The guilt had almost broken her, and their marriage. Laura was consumed with the thought of whether Rose would have survived if she'd gone to the doctors when she'd slept through her first feeding. The thing that saved them both was her getting pregnant again. 10 months later, when Daniel was born, Laura had vowed to whichever presence might be listening that she'd devote her life to this tiny creature and never let anything happen to him. And in return, could he be kept safe? The cat lowered itself onto her soft thighs, half closing his eyes in relief at the fox's disappearance, and Laura stroked his fur. He watched the demented moths with occasional darting eyes, but was either too lazy or tired to actually do anything about them. As Laura swung gently in the seat, she thought fondly of this girl she'd not yet met, this girl who was the same age her own daughter would have been. 4. Saturday, June 7. In her life, Cherry had never been on 3 dates, one night after the other. They headed into Hyde Park, past the Golden Albert Memorial and across the Serpentine. Daniel was carrying a picnic hamper backpack, while she held the blanket. It was hot against her body, and she moved it, trying to have as little contact with it as possible. The blazing heat of the day had subsided into a Mediterranean-like evening. It was still light, and would be for at least another 4 hours, and the park was full of people filled with a spontaneous holiday-like zest and optimism. Cherry was starting to enjoy herself. They'd gotten past the first couple of dates, with their potential for awkwardness and bouts of extreme politeness, and invisible ties had started to form. She knew he was extremely focused on becoming a cardiologist, liked cycling and whitewater rafting, and wrote using his left hand but ate with his right. He knew she liked strawberries, but not strawberry jam. Her father had died when she was young, and she'd lived in a flat with her mum, whom she'd rarely seen because her mum had had to work. She'd kept to herself that the flat was in a run-down part of Croydon, in the midst of streets that were constantly littered with debris, empty beer cans, discarded soft furnishings and general detritus, unidentifiable sodden rags that looked as if they still contained something misshapen inside their dirtied casings. There was little money when Cherry was growing up, even less so when her father had died. He'd been so stupid, so selfish as to not have life insurance. Her mother had had to increase her hours at the monolithic superstore on the edge of the town, just to keep their tiny flat, and Cherry found her material world shrinking from low-budget fashion to hand-me-downs, no vacations except the occasional day trip to the beach, and embarrassments at school. No money for a copy of the annual photo when all her friends were crowded round, giggling over who stood next to whom in the yearbook picture, while Cherry stood aside, excluded and self-conscious. She had hated being poor. No, Cherry kept all this to herself, and said something vague about coming from Surrey, which Croydon used to be part of, albeit many hundreds of years ago. More information changed hands, and with familiarity came warmth, and gentle teasing reinforced those tender bonds. They'd also had their first kiss, a not unpleasant experience. In fact, Cherry knew she found Daniel extremely attractive. They reached the fenced-off arena where tonight's concert was to take place. Daniel handed over the tickets he'd miraculously managed to get hold of at such short notice, and they were in. They followed the throngs to the grassy seating area, and she let Daniel choose a place that had a good view of the stage. He laid out the blanket and she sat down, stretching her long, lightly tanned legs out in front of her. She noticed that quite a few people had brought portable chairs, and was faintly aggrieved that they didn't have the same. She suspected after a few hours her backside would feel the hard ground beneath it, but then the London Symphony Orchestra started to warm up, and she made an effort to put it out of her mind. "I used to come here every year when I was young," said Daniel. "We'd walk over, bringing tea with us. It was Mum's way of educating me in classical music." So this was his local park. It was a far cry from what she'd grown up with, the careworn bleak collection of paint-peeling apparatus that had always harboured a few lifeless teenagers, like mould you couldn't quite get rid of. Cherry had never been to a classical concert before, although she made a point of listening to Classic FM every now and then. She thought she'd carefully test him out with this news. "First time for me. With classical, anyway." He batted her statement away.
"Trust me, you missed nothing before now. At least, I never really appreciated it when I was younger. Early 20s is the perfect time to enjoy classical. It says so in the scriptures."
She smiled, pleased with the way that went. It seemed she was not to be judged for cultural holes in her upbringing, which made her relax a little. Should she ever make a faux pas or misunderstand something, it hopefully wouldn't put him off her.
"So this means, then," she said, accepting the chilled glass of Chablis in the obligatory plastic glass that he poured for her, "that we are at our peak."
"The entire proms line-up beckons. What are you doing the first Friday in July?"
She thought quickly as to what he could be referring to, and remembered what she'd heard on the radio. It was the very first concert, the start of the BBC Proms' annual 8 weeks of classical music. "Standing in the Royal Albert Hall, waving a Union Jack?"
"It's a date," he said, laughing,
and they looked at each other, both glad they'd banked something for the future, and each had been as keen as the other. Then the music started to play, and she watched the violinists bow fiercely in unison, each musician pouring his heart into the score. Goosebumps appeared on her arms, and she turned and smiled at him in a way that made him catch his breath.
"I wish I had a talent like that,"
she whispered admiringly before turning her face back to the stage. Daniel sneaked little glances at her while she was watching the orchestra. He loved how there was something refreshing about her newness to things. Old girlfriends, sisters of his friends from school, had been hard to surprise, and some even harder to please. He'd often felt jaded just by being in their company. Cherry, although far from gauche, hadn't been hothoused since a toddler, and he found he could enjoy a classical concert that he'd experienced many times before just by being there with her. He suddenly felt an urge to share even more with her. Galleries, concerts, trips to the coast, maybe even a holiday abroad. There and then, the summer took on a new promise. As Mozart's symphony lifted her and dropped her back down again, Cherry sensed she was being watched, and she let him. She enjoyed the attention, and it was nice to have it from someone of quality, something that had only happened once before in her life. It had been 6 months since she'd last seen Nicholas Brandon, but his face was as clear as if he sat in front of her right now. She'd persuaded an old school acquaintance to go out for a drink, on the pretext of wanting to catch up, only the place she chose was a small, discreet, upmarket cocktail bar, some way from both of their homes. She walked in, her friend exclaiming in loud admiration behind her at the surroundings, and there he was, as she knew he would be. She opened her purse and took out some money. "Do you mind getting these? I'm going to the loo." Her friend went to the bar, and Cherry walked toward Nicholas. When she was only a couple of yards away, he looked up, and the startled, embarrassed look on his face both gratified and pained her. He was the eldest son of a telecommunications mogul, and was in his last year of a master's in economics at Oxford as a precursor to the training he'd get at his father's side. Eventually, he was destined to take over the family business. He'd grown up on the Webb estate, a gated residential conservation area housing multi-million-pound mansions in the very southern part of Croydon, where the 100-year-old rules included a banning on the wearing of shorts and hanging out washing in the garden. She saw him glance around as if he was pretending he hadn't noticed her, but there was no way on earth she was going to let him escape. She advanced right up to his table until he had no option but to acknowledge her.
"Hi," he said, feigning surprise.
"How yourself? Didn't think I'd see you here."
"Michaelmas break, and we finished last week."
She knew this because she'd looked up the dates for the Christmas holidays on the university's website.
"So, you still come here?"
he said. It had been their place, one that he'd brought her to on their first date, and she remembered the times they'd held hands across the table and made plans for when he left to go back to university. She was going to change her shifts so that she no longer worked weekends at the restaurant where they'd met, and instead visit him at Oxford. It hadn't struck her at the time that all the plans had been to his benefit more than hers.
"Last time, probably. I'm moving."
"Oh, yes? Where to?"
"Kensington."
It wasn't strictly true, but there was enough truth in it.
"Oh?"
A tiny, disbelieving smile crossed his face, as if she'd gotten confused about where and what Kensington actually was.
"What, you don't think I'm good enough?"
He frowned and looked away.
"It's not like that."
"No, I remember you saying your parents had certain demands on you. Things you said weren't your ideas, but you had no choice if you ever wanted a chance to take over your father's business."
She looked up as a girl, a beautiful silken blonde, approached the table from the direction of the restrooms, a look of consternation on her face. Cherry stood stock still, her heart hammering. He hadn't wasted any time. This was the kind of girl his parents would approve of. A girl with money, a good background, good connections.
"Is everything okay?"
she said suspiciously, looking from one to the other.
"Fine," said Nicholas quickly.
"Here you go, one apple martini,"
said her friend, thrusting a glass at her. She saw Nicholas look up. It was a drink he'd introduced her to, and she immediately wished she hadn't ordered it. She turned sharply and walked away, and heard the blonde girl sit down and ask hushed questions about who she was. When she got to the bar, she looked back and saw them huddled. He was trying to persuade her to drink up so they could leave, and all of a sudden, Cherry didn't want to be the one left behind. She threw back her drink, grabbed her friend's hand, and announced they were going. It wasn't how she'd planned it. She wanted him to be impressed, wonder if he'd made a huge mistake dumping her at the end of the summer, maybe even realize he wanted her back. For Cherry had always believed Nicholas would rescue her, pluck her from the celebrity chef's restaurant chain where she worked, a dead-end mistake of a job that she should never have had. She'd been destined for better things. Incredibly bright at school, she was too much for the overstretched teachers who'd just given her more work and let her get on with it. When she'd left with 5 top-grade A-levels, she was completely broke. University was out of the question. She just couldn't afford it. It wasn't just the cost and the debt. Cherry had an urge to escape from her poverty-ridden lifestyle. She wanted to do the most simple of things, like learn to drive, move away from home, start to create a life for herself. But her generation was entering a future that had very little to offer. Unemployment for the under-25s was at an all-time high, and they certainly had no hope of buying a home. Instead, their long-term financial burden would be paying off the nation's debt. In desperation, she disappeared on a working vacation to Australia with her meagre savings from a Saturday job, thinking that there would be opportunities there, that she would try a number of different jobs and someone would notice her cleverness, her potential. But she soon realized it was a treadmill of fruit-picking and waiting tables. Worse, she'd felt poor. She wasn't meant for backpacking. So she'd come back, and the only job she'd been able to get was as a hostess at the restaurant. A step above waiting tables. What was supposed to be a temporary had slipped 1 year into the next, and she'd watched incensed as the graduates and the training programs got fast-tracked to managerial positions and bigger paychecks. People her own age who were less smart than she was, but who had been able to afford university, apparently received automatic kudos. Just when she was at her lowest, Nicholas had come along and her world opened up again. Being with him made her feel good, feel special, like she belonged. Her brain re-engaged as they debated how to fix the economy and youth unemployment. He gave her a taste of what life with money was like, and she had held her head high in the fancy restaurants and been a natural at picking out a good wine. Then it all ended abruptly one Saturday evening, when instead of picking her up as planned, Nicholas had phoned to tell her his parents wanted him to concentrate on university, and they felt she was a distraction. They were forcing him to choose between her and a role at the family business, and he couldn't put her through an uncertain future, which he might well have if he wasn't gifted a job with his father. The breakup devastated her. All the time that she'd been honest about her humble upbringing, the inadequate school, the working-class family, it had been a bitter mistake. She realized, by the way he'd cast her aside, that she wasn't going to find her opportunities being who she was. So Cherry decided she would reinvent herself. Then she would immerse herself in the world in which she aspired to belong. Only this time, she wasn't going to tell anyone where she came from. All through her school years, Cherry had had one loyal ally, an ally that fought side by side with her to put her in a better place. Books. Or more commonly, the internet. It was extraordinary what you could learn. She'd read avidly, one link pulling her to another, until before she knew it, she'd woven an intricate web of self-acquired knowledge. Added to this were day-to-day world affairs from The Guardian, where she'd absorbed the language of the erudite journalists and carefully eliminated any last trace of Croydon from her voice. But when she'd gone for the interview at Highsmith and Brown Real Estate Agency, she'd felt reassuringly well-armed. With her few embellishments on her resume, the research from her false persona as a Chelseaite, along with that web of knowledge she'd worked so hard to create, she landed the job. It had been 5 months since she'd joined, almost to the day. She knew because she'd seen the date approaching in her diary, marked with a red circle that was placed there as a target, or maybe a warning. And so far, the only male attention she'd had come from the window cleaner. "All right, love," he said as she changed the sales details in the window, and she stiffened before checking whether anyone had taken any notice. He continued to cast glances at her as he swooped his squeegee in arcs over the window, and she fumed with humiliation. Why couldn't he chat up one of the other girls, Abigail or Emily? She felt he would see through all she'd built up and recognize a kindred working-class spirit. She was horrified that his attention might expose her. "Talk to me again, and I'll have you fired for hitting on me," she said, then turned her back. Other than that, they were married, gay, coming in with their girlfriends, or so far up their own arses that they didn't notice her. But all that was behind her now. Finally, her luck had changed. As the orchestra got up for the interval, Daniel turned to her.
"What do you think?"
She was suddenly filled with a heart-soaring happiness. Here she was on a glorious summer evening at a classical concert with a man who seemed intent on making sure she had a good time.
"It's fantastic."
She looked around and sensed she could spot those with money. The girls were made up of a disproportionate number of blondes, their hair effortlessly honeyed and falling in long waves that they tossed from side to side, knowing it would fall coquettishly back over their eyes. The boys were tanned, and their expensively casual shirts fell outside shorts that were slung low over buttocks. The same as the boys back, she had never said home, where her mother lived, but the difference between here and her part of Croydon was the cost of the underpants. She felt a sense of fierce pride that she could hold her head up amongst them. She was no different from these people. In fact, she was probably smarter, and the fact she'd made it so far proved she was capable. It just went to show what you could achieve if you thought about it and put some effort into it. For the first time in a long time, she felt she was creating some real distance from her upbringing.
"Can you play anything?"
she asked. "I was forced to learn the piano until I was 15.
"Forced?"
"Actually, it wasn't that bad." He looked at her and felt he could say it. "My teacher's daughter, who was 3 years older than me, used to sunbathe in the garden in full view of the double doors from the music room." She laughed and thought, "It's good that he can be relaxed enough to tell me these things." Cherry genuinely didn't mind hearing them. She knew men hated high-maintenance women, and she would save the jealous outbursts for when they had purpose, to bring him into touch with how much she cared. It was one of those cards worth saving.
"You?"
Cherry had already decided not to lie too much about her background if it could be helped. Lies had a nasty habit of catching up to you. Still, this friendship was at a fledgling stage, and there was no need to weigh it down with the dreary truth that there hadn't been the room for a piano, even if there had been the money. There was barely room for the sickly cream leather sofa her mum had saved money for, eyeing it in a DFS discount store until the sales started. It had built-in reclining seats, something Cherry found diabolically tasteless. "I wasn't really the musical type. Languages were my thing. French especially."
"Fluent?"
"Oui."
"Any others?"
"Spanish."
"Impressed."
"And Italian."
"Really?"
She shrugged modestly. "They're all very similar. You just have to think about it."
"You must have been good at school."
"I was, except they only did French."
"So how?"
"Taught myself. Downloaded courses."
"Wow."
He looked at her with renewed admiration.
"Wow, I could have done with you on my grand tour."
"You had a grand tour?"
"My mother's idea. It was great. We took the Orient Express as far as we could, her idea again, then trained across Europe. I got to see some amazing places."
Cherry, who had only been abroad once, to Australia, was taken with the idea of a long sojourn through Europe's best cities. But they didn't have time to talk any more, as the orchestra started warming up again, so they rearranged themselves to face the stage. Cherry sat with her arms around her knees and watched avidly, wondering how long it would take to learn to play an instrument at such a level, and if she might start learning. There were probably lessons online. After a while, Daniel put his arm loosely around her right thigh, and she felt a thrill at the possessiveness, this first touch of its kind. Then she leaned against him, and they exchanged small, intimate smiles every so often.
"It seems early,"
said Daniel as they walked back across the park after the concert had finished. It was still light, the evening was long and inviting, and both had their minds on what was going to happen next. Neither wanted to go home yet. "Do you fancy a drink?" asked Cherry, looking dubiously at the packed, trendy bars where people were spilling out onto the streets.
"We're a bit laden,"
said Daniel, indicating the picnic wear. "You want to take that back?"
"And have Mum insist on meeting you."
He smiled at her.
"As much as I'd like that, she'll have to wait."
Cherry's heart jumped with delight. Daniel was already thinking about introducing her to his mother. She thought about it and decided that they already had another date in the bag, and if they woke up together, there was a very strong possibility they'd spend all of tomorrow together too. She could make him wait until he moved into the apartment he'd just had an offer accepted on, but that was still a few weeks away. She felt that was too long. "I've got a nice bottle of Sancerre in the fridge." He smiled.
"Thank God one of us has got their own place."
He made it sound as if her situation were the preferable one, even though he was in the multi-million-pound house. When he'd told her where he lived, she knew exactly how much it was worth. Then she'd Google Earthed it, homing in to see as much detail as possible until the picture had blurred. They smiled at each other, each knowing the path they'd just taken. He took her hand and held it all the way to the tube, just like they were a couple. 5. Monday, June 9. Laura sat in the large reception area at ITV Towers, grateful for the air conditioning. She'd come a long way since she'd worked there in her early 20s as a script editor in the drama department. It was the same time Howard had swept her off her feet, and she'd given it all up when Rose, then Daniel, had arrived. It was only when Daniel reached his teens that she suddenly found she had time on her hands, and so had tentatively tested the commissioning waters with an idea for a new drama she had. Some of her old contemporaries were now running the drama departments at the channels, and after a few "remember me" emails, the industry was incestuously small, she got those first important meetings, then sold the idea. 7 years later, and she had a small but thriving company, and was, she thought, respected in the industry. Admittedly, the BAFTA win had been some years ago now, but everyone knew how arbitrary and how fashion-dependent these things were. At the moment, a comedienne, who'd also branched out in drama, was at the top of everyone's wish list, and every proposal with her name on it got greenlit, and, it was hoped, would go on to win prizes. In 2 years' time, it would be someone else. She checked her iPhone for messages. Daniel had not come home Saturday night, as she'd suspected. As Sunday had stretched on, she'd become ever more aware of his continuing absence. She'd made him lunch, but had to put it in the fridge. And then she'd sort of drifted around the house, waiting for him to return, looking forward to seeing him, and getting more and more restless the later he became. By 5 o'clock, it suddenly occurred to her that he might not come back that night either, and she laughed at herself and at the sensation she had of being stood up. She gave herself a stern talking to, and went to bed, having not seen either of her immediate family all day, as Howard had gone to golf. Her name was called, and she stood as the PA to the commissioning editor of drama came to take her up in the elevator to the 8th floor, where she sat in a small meeting room with Hercule Poirot on the window.
"Laura!"
cried Alison, as if she was welcoming a long-lost friend. They kissed each other on both cheeks. Alison always spoke in inflated tones of optimism and energy, and Laura generally found it best to respond in kind.
"How have you been?"
gushed Alison, taking a seat on one of the plastic chairs. Laura sat opposite.
"Good. Well, we're thrilled with Ep 1.
Alison also littered her sentences with extravagant adjectives. Superb, extraordinary, fantastic were also to be found often, prowling around like ninjas, waiting to attack in a showy display of power. Laura took an inner sigh of relief, but it was a bittersweet pill. She'd done the last-minute changes to the final scene as Alison had suggested, after having her argument that the lovers wouldn't have left without saying goodbye to the jilted best friend swept aside in Alison's trademark passive-aggressive way.
"I don't know, I just don't believe it, do you?" she had said, and Laura had thought, "Yes, I do, as did you, presumably, when you read the script 6 months ago."
She tried to persuade Alison otherwise, but had hit a brick wall. Laura knew that if she wanted a second series or any other commission with ITV in the near future, she'd have to not be difficult and do as she was being asked. The director, naturally upset at the last-minute major change to his work, was comforted with the promise of 2 episodes on the hoped-for next series.
"The ending really works for me now. I saw it this morning and I was..."
Alison clutched her bosom in theatrical agony. The young PA silently brought in 2 cups of tea and left them on the glass table before leaving again. Laura said thank you, while Alison pulled a face that threatened to break into tears.
"I'm glad it works for you."
She knew, as did everyone in the business, that Alison needed a hit badly. Her recent run of new dramas had failed to make the expected viewing figures, and when this happened, people got fidgety. Nobody in TV liked to be around failure, and the finger of blame was already starting to seek out a victim. Alison had a particular talent for dodging its trajectory, but even she was arming herself with reinforcements. Her ego, being what it was, thought that she had just saved a good drama and turned it into a mind-blowing drama.
"I've spoken to Sean, and he wants to know what else Cavendish Pictures might be able to do for us."
There was her reward, and this time the relief was sweeter. Times had been hard for the independent production industry the last couple of years, and Laura needed a new commission. Sean was the head of drama and had the power to greenlight. The fact he wanted to work with her again was very good news indeed.
"Do you have anything you wanted to chat to us about?"
Laura thought about her ideas slate. There were a couple of new ones that she had already earmarked to pitch to ITV.
"Yes. Fantastic. Can you send over some treatments?"
"Of course."
and we'd like to set a meet, just the three of us.
Great.
Laura pulled out her iPhone as Alison did the same. Tap, tap, stroke. He's rather busy until next month, so should we say the 18th of July?
Here?
We'll take you to lunch.
Lovely.
Look forward to it. That settled, Alison pushed her phone aside. All the news had been delivered, and the meeting came to a natural close. More kisses and an exchange of fantastic working with you, and Laura made her way back onto the street. She glanced at her watch, almost 3 o'clock. She decided not to trek all the way back to her Covent Garden office. It was too hot. The heat wave had been in the news this morning, and it was 90 degrees in London. The afternoons were always the worst, when the dust and the fumes seemed to envelop you and stick to your skin. Instead, she called her PA to say she'd be working from home for the rest of the day. Hailing a black cab, she jumped in. Once they hit Kensington, the traffic was as usual, snarled with the school run, and her driver took a shortcut down Gloucester Road. Laura had been running through her mind all the projects she could pitch to Alison and Sean, and had been unaware of her route until now. She looked out the window and, seeing where she was, sat up in her seat. There it was, on the corner of Old Brompton Road, blue and brown signage. It came closer and closer to them, and then, just a few yards before they got there, she called through the glass.
"You can drop me off here, thanks."
She paid and waited for the cab to drive off, and then made her way along the pavement to Highsmith and Brown. Laura stood, not quite in front of the windows, and looked in at an angle, pretending to check the photos of exclusive properties displayed in front, but really trying to see the personnel in the office behind. The combination of the reflections on the window, her position, and the fact she was still wearing her sunglasses made it difficult to see anything. In the end, she gave up, lifted her glasses onto her head, moved to the right, and stared in. They were all busy, which gave her more opportunity to try to work out which one Cherry was, but then she didn't have to, as it was obvious. She was stunning. Cropped, lustrous, dark brown hair that showed off her beautifully structured face, and a body that would make men weep. Laura watched for a moment, taken aback by how beautiful she was. No wonder Daniel was smitten. She was pleased for him, but... No but. She could see how someone could be so besotted. She smiled. She was pleased. Cherry attended to a customer, and Laura saw her face light up, youthful, determined. The sheer force of life in her was intimidating. Laura quickly looked away. She suddenly felt embarrassed at having been spying, and smiled a foolish smile to herself. She walked on, but the image of Cherry came with her. Laura turned down a residential street, leaving the bustle behind. As she passed the stuccoed white houses, gleaming in the sun, flanked by evenly spaced trees with their generous shade, she found herself wondering what Cherry was like. What were 24-year-old girls like these days? What would Rose have been like if she'd lived? Then she knew what she wanted to do. She set her shoulders determinedly back and made her way home.
"Why don't you invite her for supper?"
"What?"
Laura had come back to her house to find Daniel home, but sleeping. Now they were all seated around the large table for dinner, and the three of them seemed to tip it back down and keep it afloat. Neither she nor Howard had mentioned Saturday night's little scene, but enough time had passed for it to have drifted away from them. Neither brought it up.
"Your mother's dying to know more about her."
Laura ignored him. She noticed he didn't ever read the paper when Daniel was home.
"We want to meet her, don't we, Howard?"
"Sure,"
deadpanned Howard. Daniel laughed.
"Already? I've not even been seeing her a week." "It's not me putting the pressure on," said Howard.
Laura resisted the urge to huff.
"Howard, if you want to see your son this summer, I would recommend a little more enthusiasm. He's already blown us off once, remember?"
"Am I in trouble over that?"
asked Daniel.
"Terrible trouble," said Laura. "And I have a feeling you might be seeing a lot more of Cherry this summer, and so before you both disappear into some," she sighed wistfully, "blissful bubble, it would be nice to meet her."
Daniel nodded.
"You make a good point."
"Call her now."
"Now? What's the rush?"
"I need to be able to plan. Why don't we say Thursday? 6:30?
Laura wasn't entirely sure why she was pushing it so much. She knew she was unlikely to see Daniel as much as she'd hoped over the summer. As much as she'd been looking forward to it, she was accepting of the circumstances. Grown sons have their own agendas.
but something made her want to get to know Cherry before they disappeared. Daniel was on the phone. He covered the mouthpiece.
She can't do Thursday,
Laura thought quickly.
Friday, then?
This was passed down the line and seemed to hit success.
Call you again later,
Daniel said softly, then hung up.
She'd love to come.
Laura smiled. She was surprised by how much she was looking forward to it. 6. Thursday, June 12. Every time Cherry went to visit her mother, she resolved that this time she would be different. She would be open, friendly, relaxed. She would talk to her without snapping and without feeling panicked, trapped by all the things that reminded her of her penniless childhood. It wasn't her mum's fault that they'd had no money all those years, but as soon as she was let into the small two-bedroom flat, it seemed to suck out all her good intentions. The large-screen TV, too big for the room, the fluffy rug in the middle of the living room floor, the horrible tilting sofa, the oversized tin of second-rate chocolates on the side, open for guests. Cherry knew that Wendy, her mum, valued these little perks from the supermarket. She always had first-hand knowledge of all the deals. She said they'd saved her a fortune over the years. Cherry hated supermarkets, and hated their deals even more. The trash they encourage you to buy and fill your house with. The markets bled people of every bit of their deficient wages they could trick them out of, dressing the deals up as some comradely arm about the shoulders. We're on your side. We know how you feel. Times are tough. But all the time, they were piling up huge profits. At an average of £10 each, her mum's DVD collection was worth £2,000. Correction, it had cost £2,000. It was probably worth a couple of hundred quid, if that. It frustrated Cherry that her mum never stopped to work it out.
But that's a classic, Wendy had said at the new edition of The King's Speech. It's a piece of plastic in your living room. How often do you even watch it?
Owning a classic didn't make you more of a film buff, didn't mean that you were erudite or give you an eye for quality. It made you a mug, especially when you could watch the same movie on TV or borrow it from the library. It didn't ever occur to Cherry that her mum might actually enjoy watching the DVDs, might even be grateful for them as she spent most evenings when she wasn't working alone. She never found someone that lasted after Cherry's father had died. She kissed her mum chastely, trying to avoid the usual bear hug and lipstick brush.